You're listening to the Heroes Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome back to Red Shirts and Runabouts. This is one of your weekly, bi-weekly Star Trek podcasts. We're part of the Heroes Podcast Network. I'm one of the usual hosts, Greg. I'm actually happy to be back. I had to take about a month break again on Derek just because of work getting crazy. But Derek, you're the stable one of the unit. So go ahead and say your hellos, buddy.
Hey, look, I'm glad to have you back, Greg. And we had Ray and Zach on quite a bit to help us get through Star Trek Picard. And you know, I'm sorry you missed it because I know you've got some strong opinions about the show.
I do, but you know, in some cases, it's probably best if I wasn't, because sometimes I do. What's the line that you know Kirk uses in Wrath of Khan? You know, you must learn to govern your passions.
Well, you know, it's good to have differing viewpoints, and you know, for those of you who didn't catch those episodes, Ray, Zach, and I did not always agree. We did not always see eye to eye either. You know, everyone looks for something else when it comes to their fictional content. But, you know, hey, look, we have plenty of time before the next show. So maybe, Greg, you and I will have a season one wrap up at some point so you can vent a little bit. You know,
I will say it is kind of even reading online, which is always dangerous these days. Yeah. But even listening to other podcasts and YouTubers, a lot of discussions on Raffi anymore is they feel that the actress had a raw deal, which I agree with because they kind of built her up a little bit. And then she said horrible stuff happened to her. And yet that scene that you heard me rant about when Picard's like laughing at her when she's drunk on the bridge, which is anyways, we're not here to talk about Picard, though.
No, we're not. So in our first episode with Greg back, and as a reminder, we are bi-weekly for the time being, at least I would imagine until the next show kicks off and we have weekly content from that standpoint. But we decided this week to talk about a topic that a lot of our friends and followers and listeners have been interested in, and that is starship design. And Greg, I know this is a topic you've wanted to talk about for a really long time.
Well, it's something that I've always loved with Star Trek is they've always been able to do fun looking designs. Like, so a good buddy of mine, Brent, and I have been watching Star Trek remotely. We've been starting with the movies again, kind of like what you've done a few times. And, you know, even when we're watching Star Trek 1, like the Klingon D7 battlecruiser, there's just something so iconic of the design. And I don't know if it's because it's Klingon or what. It's just the design is good. And then you have, that's the thing with Star Trek, and that's why I was a little disappointed with the Picard finale, was the copy-paste ships, and everybody kind of explaining it away, like, well, remember, Starfleet's inward. And I'm like, well, Riker still rallied a fleet of like 300 battleships in about 12 hours, so they're not that inward. You know what I mean? It's not like, you remember how when the Borg invaded Earth, and, you know, Wolf 359, and they could only scramble up like 40 ships?
Times have changed.
Times have changed.
After the Dominion War.
And it's a fun topic, though, because it's one of those topics where there's truly no right or wrong. Like, people can get together and admit, you know, man, Next Generation Season 1 was kind of rough. But with starship design, it's always going to be truly based on people's personal opinions, even the old school model making days. Mm-hmm. I think that's what I love about motion pictures, all the ships built with the actual old, you know, naval ship model plastic parts and everything. I miss those.
Yeah, you know, you talk about the motion picture, and that movie, I think, gets a bad rap a lot, especially in modern times, because it's slow. You know, it's kind of like 2001, A Space Odyssey. It's designed to be very philosophical, very thoughtful, very purposeful. And, you know, you take the story equation out of it, because we could have a whole analysis about that, but the visuals are quite gorgeous, and the models that they use for all of the ships, including the large-scale V'ger, are really incredible. And you know, the goal of this episode is we're going to be talking about Starfleet ship design, so I don't want to spend too much time on this, but the D7 is absolutely one of my favorite Star Trek ship designs that's out there, just across the board. I've always loved it.
And the last thing I'll say about the motion picture, because you're right, we should move on, is I would argue that the motion picture visually looks better than 1977 Star Wars. Mm. I'm not saying the movie had a better story. Obviously, I don't think it did. Star Wars A New Hope is near and dear to everybody. It's near and dear to me. But visually, there are no flaws with the motion picture.
Yeah, I mean, it's gorgeous. And I think maybe part of the problem is it knows it's gorgeous, right? So you've got the scene where Kirk and Scotty are on the little little pod going up to the Enterprise. And it's like a 10-minute scene. And look, the model's gorgeous, okay? It really, truly is. But even I'm like, let's get going. You know?
The joke, you can go get your brakes done and come back, and that scene is still going on, yeah.
It's true, though. It kind of just goes on forever. And I get it. It was their big return, their triumphant return, and they had a budget, and they had talented people, and they wanted to show that off, to show what they had. And, you know, this can kind of segue into our conversation, because that's our first look at, you know, true full production quality Star Trek ships, because the show was, you know, almost 15 years before this on a TV show budget, and this is your first film, and you get that refit of the Enterprise, the refit of the Constitution class, what is arguably the most iconic ship in Star Trek, which is the Constitution class, right? You know, you have someone draw the little four ovals that are connected to each other, and everybody knows what that is. And I think this was kind of what made it truly mainstream, was this refit. It's really pretty gorgeous. It's definitely one of my top five favorite designs.
Well, and I think that's a good topic to start with, because we could talk. I mean, this kind of episode we could probably spend 12 hours on alone. Mm-hmm. But even the original story of the Constitution class, how they only had like 12.
Yes.
People may not be aware of it, but that's like a thing in history where even when the United States was first making its first real wooden navy, and it was basing its design on a number of ships based on things like the number of colonies and the number of certain names they wanted to use, there was always like a thing that drove what they were going to build and how many they were going to build back then. That's naval tradition. Like today, even how they name certain carriers after famous people, it's tradition. And so like the first 12 Constitution class ships, and then you go to a show like Battlestar Galactica, the old one and the new one, is they had like one Battlestar for every one of the colonies. It's like, that's what they started with. And then they expanded kind of like the 12 Constitutions. And like you pointed out during our Discovery review, was the Klingons considered the Constitution class like a game changer for the Quadrant. It was that powerful and modular of a ship. It could explore, it was fast, and it could do battle.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's hard to talk about the Constitution class in finite detail, because there's so many variations on it over the years, right? You had the original version that we had on TV, and even that has, you know, multiple variations to it, depending on, was it the cage pilot? Was it Where No Man Has Gone Before pilot? Was it the, you know, the Mirror Universe version, and so forth? And then when you get to the films, when it was refit, you know, it was even more different. You know, the ships, of course, recognizable, but basically everything was changed within it, because it had to be for a film. That's the real world answer. And you have a crew that, in the original show, you know, Kirk's show, the crew was about 200 people, right? Memory Alpha says 203, to be specific. And then in the films, it's 430, you know, and so the refit doubles the capacity of the ship, which is, you know, I guess maybe that just means more bunk beds like we see in the Undiscovered Country on the A. But, you know, this ship went from its infancy, where there were just 12 copies of it, right? We see the, you know, the Defiant, there's the Constitution, and so forth, and they're all exactly the same. And that is something that Star Trek continues to use later on, where you will see reused designs over and over again. The Excelsior class, the Oberth class, the Galaxy class, these are all used time and time again, especially when you see, you know, anytime an Admiral shows up on TNG, it's pretty much on an Excelsior class ship, right?
that's the joke. Yeah, it's their personal Excelsior, right?
Yeah, and then, you know, in the Dominion War, you see, you know, there's just a bunch of Galaxy class starships and things of that nature, and that makes a lot of sense. Whereas, like, you know, certain other science fiction, even Star Wars doesn't do this completely because even it has like multiple X-Wings and multiple Y-Wings, but there's a little more variety because a lot of those people, it's their ship, right?
Yeah, it's like it's owned by some family or some group, or the rebels are building ships out of whatever they can build, like a real rebellion group would do. And we've always joked about the whole Excelsior class admiral thing, but so being the history nerd I am, because you know that's like my side profession as a historian, during the Gulf War we actually reactivated one of our old battleships that was built in World War II.
Oh wow.
And it deployed to the Persian Gulf for fire support, and everybody's like, what are we doing reactivating this 50-year-old ship? And the Navy's like, because this 50-year-old ship has 9 16-inch guns that fire freight trains at the enemy, so we don't need to use our missiles, because our missiles back then, we've been at war now for 20 years in the right now, so we've got missiles everywhere, but in the first Gulf War, we didn't, so they were trying to conserve. And the Navy and the logistics staff were like, it's cheaper for us to reactivate and use this. And by the way, Iraqi troops were interviewed after the war, and they said even the sound of those guns was terrifying. And you kind of see that with Starfleet, is they never really throw anything away. It's like, they keep it somewhere.
And you're right. And, you know, you can kind of extrapolate a bit, because like, just look at our commercial airline fleets, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of these planes have been in service for as long as I've been alive. You know, you're talking planes that are 25, 30, 35 years old that are still in service. And if that's in the 20th and 21st century, I would certainly hope that the lifespan of our vehicles has doubled by the 24th century. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look at our even modern day Navy, the submarines, the Los Angeles class nuclear submarine, some of them are 30 years old and they're being removed out of service, not because they're breaking, because the Navy's like, well, we just don't need them. But they're fine. I mean, there's still maintenance because it's a nuclear reactor. But overall, the technology, the ships are still well maintained. They're well built. I mean, they could still use them. We're still flying B-52s that are 55 years old or something, and they still fly fine.
And so the Federation does this. Now, what's interesting is you see Excelsior-class starships in the TNG DS9 Voyager era, but you don't see Constitution-class starships. And I think that's a very interesting question. Is it that none of them really survived, and the ones that did were just so historic they were made into, you know, mothballed museums? Or, you know, were they put out of service because of a flaw that had been, you know, fixed by the Ambassador class or something along those lines? What is it about the Excelsior class that kept people coming back to it? I wonder.
My belief is it was entirely writer story driven, is because the Excelsior you only saw in Star Trek 3 doesn't really do anything. But it was a cool looking ship. It still is a cool looking ship. But they also, I think they wanted to completely distinguish modern Star Trek from the original series. That's my belief. But you bring up a good point about the Excelsior, and I'm kind of skipping ahead here, but it's a great topic. So the Excelsior is not only such an aged design that still holds up. You remember the episode of DS9, what was it, Paradise Lost or Paradise Fallen, where they're worried about a Dominion infiltration of Earth, and Sisko's put in command, and the Lakota's trying to stop the Defiant, the Lakota's of an Excelsior class. Mm-hmm. And the first time they fire on the Defiant, I can't remember if it was Kira or somebody, she's like, looks like somebody's been upgrading that ship, because it just knocked our shield down 20%. Mm-hmm. It's like, in less than any time, they were able to upgrade that ship to essentially, you know, 2480 standards. Mm-hmm. 2380 standards, excuse me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe there's just something about its design that's more modular, you know, more upgradable. You know, because it's, according to Memory Alpha, the Excelsior class starship was in service for 90 years, from the 2280s to the 2370s. And that's a good long while. And I wonder if maybe it was just things like the Dominion War that finally pushed the Federation to say, we just need new stuff, you know, like the Akira class and things like that.
I mean, sometimes there is something to be said for just strengthen numbers, get as many ships out there for the less important combat zones. But hell, I mean, the Dominion still took Beta Zed, so I mean, obviously some of our fleets weren't doing so good. And that's actually it's a joke Brent, my buddy Brent and I have been saying for years, is when the Dominion War first starts and the Sisko's talking to the command crew and Bashir comes in, he's like, oh, we just heard from the 7th Fleet or whatever. And Sisko's like, oh, well, how's it going? He's like, well, only 12 ships made it back. And General Martok's like 12 out of 104. And at that point, you're like, holy shit, the Federation is not only losing, they're getting... I mean, imagine you and I go to work and we're like, sir, we just had a 90% failure rate. On, you know, it's so, it's, yeah, it's fun thinking about all the ships they put out. And I think you're right. The Dominion War created that realism. What was it? I don't think we ever heard about it. I don't think it's Alpha Canon. I think it's Beta Canon, that whole Franken fleet thing they did, where supposedly they were building ships just out of, like, whatever spare parts they had.
I mean, there's some talk about that during the Dominion War. And, I mean, in the real world, there was lots of kit bashing, right? I mean, that's stuff that we saw during Wolf 359, for example, or the Battle of Wolf 359. And, you know, that's just a real world way of making unique, different looking ships for cheap. But I think that's something that was used during the Dominion War to get some of these ships upgraded and out of mothballs, because they were used for so long. And, you know, maybe the Excelsior class makes sense because it was the next iteration of the style used for the Constitution class. You know, it's the same kind of design, right? You've got your saucer, your secondary hull, and two nacelles, and it's basically the same structure. But another ship was in service for basically the same amount of time, but it was a much stranger design, and that's the Oberth class.
The little science vessel that could.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tiny freaking ship. You know, it's, you know, when you think like Voyager's a tiny ship, right? Well, the crew of an Oberth class was almost half of Voyager. And it was in service for basically the same time the Excelsior class was. And I wonder if that's simply because it was just a science vessel and they could just keep upgrading the sensors, you know, and putting in astrometrics labs wherever they wanted.
So there is a series of books that came out in the 80s. I think it's called like Jackals Starfleet Technical References for the Fleet. And it talks about the Oberth classes. Apparently the Oberth class was a series of designs that were extremely modular. And one of them was a science class, the Oberth class, but they could also apparently turn it into like a gunship.
There's a scout ship. Where,
yeah. Where they, where it had the offensive firepower of like a battleship, but didn't have the shields and armor. It was basically there to be really fast, get in there, do some damage and get out. Mm-hmm. And the reason that that sticks into my mind is, even though it's Beta Canon, but I'm considering it Alpha, is because there's a line in DS9 that Gul Dukat says when the Dominion are attacking DS9, and after their first wave, and, you know, Damar is like, oh, their shields are still holding, and Wei Yun's like, what's impossible? The Federation shields never can stand up to us. And Gul Dukat immediately responds with, I told you never to underestimate the Federation's technical skills. And so I do believe after something like Wolf 359, well, even going back to the original series, because you have all the ongoing conflicts with the Romulans and Klingons, you've got the M5 computer incident, and then you go into the movies, you have V'ger, you have Khan, you've got Undiscovered Country with a cloak ship that can fire, is I think it's really understood why the Federation kind of started going into a little bit more, you know, the Galaxy class is a good one. It's a science exploration ship that's good at combat. Mm-hmm. The Sovereign, the Next Enterprise, that's a warship. I mean, it may have families on board, but that is definitely a, because of everything that was going on, dealing with the Borg, dealing with all the skirmishes with the Cardassians, the Dominion, that's a warship. And that's, you know, a little new for Starfleet, that whole fleet of warships Sisko mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big difference. And I mean, just talking about, like, that was one thing I always appreciated from Dukat, was that statement, right? Because you look at what Starfleet does, and they are very quick to adapt and to learn and to evolve their technologies. You look at going back to the Constitution class, it goes from this relatively small 200-person ship, you know, with a, you know, that cruising speed of warp 2. And then by the time you're done with the A, you know, it's you know, able to hit warp 9. It's got a crew of over 400, you know, and that's a pretty big jump from the same structural designs that they had. And the next leap is that Excelsior class. And yeah, the transwarp drive is a complicated conversation when you deal with canon, because it's there 1 minute and then it means something very different later. But the design of the ship, the structure of the ship, you know, was considered very significant, very powerful. I mean, Sulu's ship, was very worthy, and for it to last 90 years, you know, continues down that line. And the Galaxy class is really where things kind of are, like, that's truly the next level. Right? We have the Ambassador class, which was the Enterprise C, and it's really just a smaller Galaxy class, right? It's really what they kind of did. They retrofitted, kind of working backwards. But the Galaxy class is where everything really changes, because you go from these essential, like, naval war vessels that were the Constitution class, and the Excelsior class wasn't any different. There weren't families on the Excelsior class. But the Galaxy class, you know, had a crew of, 1,000 people. There were family on board. There were children on board. It could hold 15,000 people in the event of an evacuation or a big diplomatic event. I mean, can you imagine? It's a floating city.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, and even I have nothing good to say to that, because you're right. I mean, people don't realize not only were their families on board, children were regularly born on the Enterprise. Mm-hmm. And it was a topic of conversation when Data made Lol. And Picard's like, you should have told us about Lol. And Data's response was, well, do the other crew members tell you when they're having a child? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's something that the Enterprise D was, and it's unfortunate, because we get to know the Enterprise D so much compared to the C and even the B, which is just a weird Excelsior variant with like an armored secondary hull type thing. But but the Enterprise D, it's actually not my favorite Enterprise design. And I know that's kind of spooky to some people in the modern era, but my favorite is still the Constitution class.
So which Constitution class? I'm just curious.
The refit.
Okay. So my favorite Enterprise, and this actually is my favorite Starfleet ship design in all of Star Trek, is the Dreadnought variant of the Galaxy class, the one that we see in All Good Things.
That was... Okay, so that was phenomenal. I mean, hopefully they just built a ton of those. The Galaxy X or something. Even though there's one more comment I want to make in the Galaxy. I mean, we can make as much as we want. Given early on, they only said they built a certain amount of Galaxy class before the Dominion War. The Yamato was lost early to the Iconian virus. The Enterprise was destroyed young in its life. That class of ships has not had a good, like, run of luck. It really hasn't.
I mean, that's fair. That's definitely a fair point. Especially when you think, like, well, if an Excelsior ship can survive for 50, 60, 70 years, and the Enterprise D is 8 years old when it's destroyed. Give or take a few months. I'd have to look at the exact dates, right? But it's after the seventh season,
Well, and, it's one of those things is, if Star Trek continues going forward the way it is, eventually we're going to see some sort of gigantic Enterprise that's like a carrier that's carrying like Defiant classes, which is just going to be hilarious to me, even if it only carries like four of them.
Well, that kind of leaps us to my least favorite Enterprise design, which is the Enterprise J from
Enterprise
TV show where Archer's in the future with Daniels. And it's, I mean, don't get me wrong, we don't get a great look at it, and we have a much better look now that there's the Eagle Moss models of it. But I just always thought it was very strange looking, very alien. And that's on purpose, right? Because by this point in the future where Starfleet, the Federation has evolved so much and so many species are involved, that the designs would depart, and that's fine. Whereas, the Galaxy class looks much more like a UFO than even the original Enterprise.
Well, it's the gigantic primary hull. I mean, if that ship was in a gravity well, it would just immediately tip over.
So that brings us then to the Sovereign class ship. And that's where things get kind of confusing as far as the evolution of this kind of ship is concerned, because most of the data that we have on it is from the films, right? First Contact, Insurrection, and Nemesis. And there's a lot of discrepancies about, like, how many decks the ship has, or how long the ship is.
I mean, First Contact brought up the issue. It's like, oh, we can't get the shuttle bay because the Borg. And you're looking at the schematics. You're like, are you sure? Because you're here and the shuttle bay is here. But you're right. It's just discrepancies with story writing.
Because, like, even so, like, I wanted to make sure I got the data correct here, right? Because I'm a stickler for that, and I know a lot of Trekkies are too. And so on Memory Alpha, if you go to the page for the Sovereign class, there's an area under technical data called physical arrangement. And there's a whole section in here about why no one's really sure what it is. Because Picard says in First Contact that it has 24 decks. But then later, Lieutenant Daniels in the same movie says 26 decks. And then in Nemesis, both Data and Worf refer to a deck 29.
This is like the hotels that don't have the level third, like the floor 13.
But then if you were to go back to the original blueprint designs for the ship that Rick Sternbach made, there's 23 decks. So...
So there's like eight different answers.
It's like 23 to 29. But what's really interesting about that, though, is regardless, 23 to 29 doesn't matter. The Enterprise D, the Galaxy class, had 42 decks.
Yeah, and we saw plenty of times them crawling through those damn Jeffrey tubes, which has just got to be the worst. But no, I mean, you bring up a good point, and I know some people laugh when fans enjoy the details, but to me, the details are everything. It's why when First Contact came out, me, like so many other fans, we saw some of those new ships, like the Akira class, just unloading torpedoes on the Borg cube, and one of the writers is like, oh yeah, the Akira class has 18 torpedo tubes, and everybody's like, what? Like, okay, that's a lot, and then they retconned it or whatever, they changed it, like, no, it only has like four. Because people are like, 18? They're like, why? It's like, at that point, might as well just have a ship that is a torpedo tube. But again, it's the differences in decks because, you know, the details are important. The details are fun. Otherwise, why even bother doing it?
Well, and I think it's important to kind of help with the comparison's sake of what it is that you're looking at, right? Because we have to make a lot of guesses a lot of the time with these ships. So, for example, with the Sovereign class, we don't really know its crew size. What we do know, based on the three films that we see it in, is that it is a harsher vessel. It appears to be more militaristic. It seems to be more cut and lean than the Galaxy class ever was. You know, the Galaxy class was the Disney cruise liner, right? And the Sovereign yep. seems much more like a speedboat with a bunch of weapons on it. You know, like, I don't know, Guile's ship from the Street Fighter movie. You know?
Wow.
It's a deep cut there.
Are we really going to, you know, Street Fighter movie? I was M. Bison going to be in the background.
Well, the boat is the best part of that movie. Guile's boat. But, you know, but that's really like the Sovereign class, you know, is a very different take. And it's an interesting question because how does it compare? Why was it designed as the next step after the Galaxy class? Was it because they wanted fewer civilians on board because of the Borg and the Dominion War? Was it that they needed more nimble ships? You know, the Sovereign class is a much smaller vessel at 685 meters. It's a much smaller ship. It's got, you know, 18 fewer decks, depending on, you know, the layout. I want to know, like, the reasoning behind that, the thought process, because it's a cool design. I like the Sovereign class. I think it's a very sexy design for a ship. It is badass. And the first time that you see it, it is gorgeous. And when it swoops in First Contact, you know, when Worf's on the Defiant and, you know, Adam Scott, you know, talks about, you know, that the Enterprise is coming in. It's a gorgeous shot of that. And the ship looks massive in that scene. Everything else around it.
Oh, it looks huge.
But it's not huge. It's like two-thirds the size of a Galaxy-class ship. So yeah. It's very interesting, and I want to know. I want to know the why. Because the Defiant, we learned so much about the Defiant. We learned so much about Voyager. And the Sovereign class, just we don't really get to know much because it's just those three films.
Well, and so I just realized we skipped over something, though, really quick. Because we talked about the Excelsior, but we don't talk about the Miranda class. Mm. That also survives. And to me, my thinking is because the Reliant was so well received by fans. I mean, everybody likes the Reliant. It's a cool looking ship. Star Trek II is one of the probably the best Star Trek film. Always one or two. But again, I think it's because it was a little assault frigate type thing, so they could build it easily, even into the 24th century. Although, you know, we got the Nebula class, which is kind of like a modern Miranda class, almost.
Yes, I agree with you completely. I can't believe I forgot about the Reliant. The Miranda class starship is a super cool design. I've always loved that style. I thought it was really unique. I've always had some story issues with Wrath of Khan, with the way how powerful they made the Miranda class seem, given that it's a pure science vessel. But
it's a frigate that does science.
It's a cool ship. Yeah. It's a beautiful design.
Yeah.
And I think you're right in that the Nebula class basically replaces it, because,
well, and they don't do the, let's be real though, the Miranda does not do well against the Dominion.
No.
Like, at all. I don't think we see a single one survive.
No, and I mean, how could it, right? It's basically a rectangle in space, you know? It'd be hard to miss it. And they're not, you know, they're not particularly, you know, maneuverable. They're slow. They're old. They're only like 4 or 5 decks. They're small ships, right? They only hold like 30 people. You know, when you're talking about size of ship, that's like the smallest one on this list. The Oberth class holds, I think, 50 people, if I remember right. No, 80 people in the Oberth class. And you're talking about, you know, 30 people on the Miranda class. But the Nebula class is interesting because one of the things the Miranda class has, and there's some offshoot classes of it, is that those modules that you can swap out, there's some different configurations, and some of them were more geared towards battle. The Nebula class is a similar concept. It's got mostly galaxy class features. It's got the same saucer section. It's got the same secondary hull, same nacelles, but they're organized differently, and they have this module on top. And that module can be swapped out for different things. Some of them are just straight up weapons arrays, torpedo bays and phasers. Others are scientific modules for studying, you know. There's some cool different things that they can do there. And I thought it was a really clever way to reuse parts for a completely different kind of ship.
Which makes complete sense, because even in real life, because I'm also a naval nut, is you have the Ticonderoga, you know, Aegis missile cruiser, and you have the Arleigh Burke Aegis missile destroyer. Their technology and some of their components are very similar to each other. The Arleigh Burke is newer, so it's got better construction, a little bit sleeker, but a lot of the components are like generational differences versus design differences. And the Ticonderoga is bigger because it's a cruiser. But you bring up the point, because even and the Nebula class is apparently so modular. You remember the episode with the Phoenix when the old Scotty's old captain goes a little rogue? I mean, he's destroying Cardassian ships with like 2 shots, including like battleships, which that's obviously a Nebula class that didn't have the science module on top. Maybe it was outfitted as more of a combat vessel for deep range patrol or something. And that's to me, that's a very Federation thing to do. You build a ship that's modular and you can change it up based on mission needs.
And I think that that's important, right? I mean, the idea that these ships would be used for different purposes over different amounts of time and hoping that they would stay in service for decades, being able to swap those things out was a big deal. I mean, one of the things that you could do actually was, instead of having that module on top, was to swap in a third nacelle.
Yeah.
You know, so it could go even faster. I mean, in that case, what is it, a rescue vessel maybe to evacuate people? You know, I mean, it's got that huge saucer section. It can probably hold a few thousand people on board.
Well, and that's what I always loved about the Constellation class, you know, the old Stargazer design with the 4 nacelles, is even reading about it, is they very rarely used all 4 nacelles at once. They would cycle 2 at a time to increase engine endurance, so it could go, it wouldn't be going warp 9.9975, but it could go warp, you know, 9.5 for a longer time than other Federation ships. And that actually brings me back to something when we were talking about the original series. Remember Voyage Home? Everybody remembers Star Trek 4. But they're on the Klingon ship as they're getting ready to go around the star. Mm-hmm. And it's like warp 5 and the ship's already like shaking. And you're like, wow. You know, you go like warp 9 on a Starfleet ship and you're like, you don't even know. But you go warp 5, 6, 7 on a Klingon ship. And it is, I like that, because Klingon ships were primarily designed for combat first. A warrior species with warrior ships, you know, Kobayashi Maru going up against three Klingon battle cruisers. It's not, you know, it's supposed to be the no-win scenario because their ships are so strong. And you go to the Federation ships that are just a little bit more technical, better with speed. And like you said, the Nebula, you can swap out modules.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Constellation class is an interesting design because I always found it visually really cool. But it's a weird-looking ship. It's kind of like a Reliant, but with four nacelles. A Miranda class, excuse me.
Yeah, and not only that, but it's hard to visualize where some of the components of the ship are. Like, okay, obviously for those of you listening, Derek and I are Star Trek nerds, but things like the deflector array that's used to push micrometeorites out of the way. Where is it? Is it on the front of the Stargazer?
I think it's on the front of the saucer, if I remember correctly.
But even then, it's without some kind of secondary hull. It does throw you off a bit on number of crew, number of the size of the ship. Because, yeah, the Miranda class, 35, 45 people. I mean, Khan had, what, 50? So his people were more than the crew of the Reliant.
I mean, basically, yeah. And, I mean, even the Constellation class only had a crew of about 40 people. You know, so these were smaller ships. And so, like, when you have, you know, Riker trying to fight the, you know, the Enterprise in the war games, it's kind of a little silly because you've got this truly massive 42 deck, 1,000 person vessel against a 40 person vessel that's got, like, I don't know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 decks maybe on the Constellation class. You know, it's interesting to see how the designs evolved and how when they needed to bring in an older design like the Ambassador class or the Constellation class, how they were able to kind of retrofit these designs in. I thought really they did a good job overall. It all feels very cohesive, you know, when you think of a Starfleet vessel. But, you know, of course, things change in Deep Space Nine. They change in Voyager. We start going in a different direction. So before we go that route, is there anything pre kind of DS9 era that you want to touch on?
I mean, not too much, because even with Next Generation, the bulk of ships we see is either the Galaxy class or the Excelsior class. I think we see the Oberth a couple times. But we don't see a tremendous amount of variety. Even Wolf 359, we don't see the battle. It's the limitation of technology and money. So even when you see the wrecked ships, you're like, there's the New Orleans class. And you're like, New Orleans class? You're like, what the hell's the New Orleans class? And you look it up online, and you're like, okay, that's just some artist's rendering of what they think it was. So yeah, I mean, DS9 is, I think, where they truly got into the variety. Because even Sisko's ship, the Saratoga, was like a Miranda class, but it wasn't.
Exactly.
it was another variant, which, if I'm going to battle with the Borg, a Miranda class is not what I want to be on. Just
definitely not.
FYI.
Okay, so then let's do this. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll move on then to the DS9 era and later, as far as Starfleet ship designs are concerned.
Recently, on the Heroes Podcast Network, Echo Station.
Well, what's the main planet that Endor... The forest moon of Endor. It's a moon. So there's a major planet, obviously, that it...
Is the forest moon of Endor? Is Endor the actual planet, then?
See, isn't that confusing? Yes. Is it the forest moon of the planet Endor, or is it the forest moon called Endor?
Kaiju Curry House.
Because I'm just wondering, are Pokemon Kaiju?
They are pocket monsters. They are pocket monsters, Paul.
They're monsters, aren't they?
They are yokai, officially.
Yokai.
Yeah, so,
What's a yokai?
Screen Heroes.
If the MCU gets that, then I really think that Space Jam needs to be part of the DCEU.
Yes!
Okay, because...
Does they have a big Marvel versus DC crossover where Air Bud takes on Space Jam? Man, we should write for these companies.
That's what it comes, it's Air Bud versus Bugs Bunny. That's what it's all come down to.
One-on-one.
Yes, done. All right. And then, like, at the end, it's Galactus versus LeBron James.
And Squirrel Girl wins.
Subscribe today at heroespodcast.com, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Spreaker, Podcast Addict, and more.
All right. We are back. So we were talking Starfleet ship designs. We've kind of wrapped up the original series through most of TNG. We talked a bit about the Sovereign class as well from... the three films, but let's kind of focus a bit on DS9 and Voyager. So we're talking Starfleet, so that we won't discuss Tarak Nor. But I do want to talk about, before we get into, you know, the Defiant, which is really the meat, I want to talk about the runabouts for a minute. They're not really starships, but they're also not shuttles. And I just wanted your take, Greg, on your opinion for the runabouts that we get in DS9.
It almost feels like the original intent was to give them, I've already used the term before, but like give the station like three little gunships to use. Because apparently they have like photon torpedoes. They don't have a lot, but they have high capacity warp. They have like a medical unit. They have a sleeping room. I mean, so they're small ships, large shuttles. But I mean, hell, even the battle with the Odyssey against the Dominion, the Federation sent three runabouts, and they're like, yeah, the runabouts are definitely going to help the Odyssey. And they're only going up against, like, what, three Jem'Hadar fighters, and it doesn't go well. Which is good. I mean, they did that on purpose to show how powerful the Dominion was. I like that. But the runabouts are that weird hybrid of too big to be a shuttle, too small to be a starship, what am I?
Because they are rather large. Like, the crew complement says, like, four on Memory Alpha, but they seem significantly larger than that. And, you know, they have different modules that can be attached on top as well, so they continued with that modularity. And, you know, they're able to hit warp 5, which, you know, is actually faster than the cruising speed of the original Enterprise.
Yep.
But I don't know. I thought it was kind of like a bit of a cop out where they were like, okay, well, we don't want to give them a starship because we want them to be on the space station. And everyone's like, well, they have to be able to go places, though. Well, yeah, they'll use the shuttles. Like, we're not going to use those slow, bulky shuttles from TNG, guys.
Yeah, the Mark IV shuttle. Yeah. No.
Like, fine. We'll give you a cooler-looking shuttle. It's bigger. It goes faster. And that's what they did.
Yeah, because it almost seems like that they were giving them that they were supposed to go out into the Gamma Quadrant and do, like, a 1 week of search and then come back. But they never really... We never really see that. We see it a few times, don't get me wrong, where they're out exploring something and Quark and Odo crash. But we, it's like I said, it's that weird just hybrid of what am I? Am I a ship? Am I a shuttle? I don't know. And I just thought about something during our break, and it's touching on an old topic, but it'll make us laugh. So my belief is the reason the old Constitution went from like 200 crew to 400 was to make room for all the shuttles that Captain Pike needed to fight Section 31. That's why. Nope, I'm never letting that go. I mean,
it's an interesting point.
So we're just adding 200 pilots? Like, yeah, just trust
me. It'll be fine.
It'll be fine. No, but yeah. So what are your takes on overall on the runabout? You think it was just kind of almost like a story idea that they kind of abandoned?
No, I mean, they don't... I wouldn't say they abandoned it. I think the problem straight up was that it was a cop-out. They were told they can't have a starship because it has to be on the space station, but they still needed something that was better than those bulky shuttlecrafts that we got on TNG, because TNG hardly ever used them. And so it was okay that they were slower, that they were boxier, that they couldn't really put up a fight. They needed something here that they could do something with. And I think that if DS9 made any mistakes, it was waiting so long to give them something like the Defiant.
So I have a conspiracy theory for the Defiant. Okay. So as I've brought up on the show multiple times, I'm also a fan of Babylon 5, which aired right around the same time as DS9. Well, early on with Babylon 5, as they always had other ships involved, but the captain of Babylon 5 essentially got an assault frigate assigned to him. That was called the White Star, and it was a very powerful mixed design, but it was tiny, it didn't have that many people, and its sole purpose was basically to fight a war. And then, like, a year later, here comes the Defiant. It two shows, each on space stations, but you're right, though, is no matter what we want, you can do a lot of interesting stories on a space station, but something Star Trek has always been about is exploration. Meeting new species, doing this, doing that. You know, introducing the Dominion gives a reason why DS9 needed the Defiant. You know, because they're like, the Dominion are hell, they rammed a Galaxy-class ship. You know, why'd they ram it? They were running away. And Sisko's like, they're showing us how far they go. And, you know, that's when Sisko's on the horn to headquarters going, all right, I need something. I worked on the Defiant. Give me the Defiant.
No, I'm with you there. I really think at the end of the day, they just wanted something that looked better than the shuttles because they were going to have to use them, you know, especially the going back and forth from Bajor to the station and things like that. They were just shot a lot. And let's talk about the Defiant. So the Defiant is something very new for us when it was first revealed in Star Trek. Up until this point, we had starships, and those starships had shuttles, and that was it. But this is something very special. This was designed for battle. It's a 50-person crew. It's five decks. It has just a shit ton of weaponry attached to it. It is very, very fast. It is incredibly nimble. Hell, the front end of it was actually designed to shoot off with quantum torpedoes inside of it to basically be like a last ditch effort ramming explosion device. You know, it had the cloak from the Romulans. It had a blade of armor, which was a new concept in Star Trek at the time. This thing was meant for war. It was meant to fight the Borg, and it was used, of course, to fight the Dominion. It was considered an escort type ship, which I always found that kind of a funny name for something because it doesn't sound as intense as it actually is.
Yeah, I mean, it's not escorting, you know, supply ships to Bajor.
Not quite.
Not quite.
But the design...
I mean, it can.
But the design was also a complete departure because every starship we've talked about up until this point had nacelles. It had warp nacelles. Now, some were, you know, oblong, some were round, you know, rectangular, like the refit of the Constitution class and the Miranda class. You know, you had what the Galaxy class and the Nebula class had. There were some different styles, but there were always these dedicated warp nacelles. The Defiant doesn't have those. It's got like built-in nacelles that are just kind of part of the hull. There's no secondary hull. There's no you know, standing nacelles. It's all one piece. And
yeah, and my only complaint of the Defiant is a ship like that, even Sisko mentions it was the first of a design, but it was overpowered, overgunned for its size and shape and all that. Is a ship like that on its own isn't entirely useful? I mean, one-on-one against a Lakota does fine, but it's also holding back. I mean, I think Worf even realizes, like, if I just fire the Quantums, I'm going to destroy the Lakota, and I can't do that. But it almost feels like there was supposed, and Sisko says it, there was supposed to be like a fleet of ships like the Defiant. And we hear about the Akira, we hear about the Steam Runner, and a few of the other ones that are like these warships. But the Defiant is the only one we get to know with any kind of level of, intimacy is the wrong word, but you kind of get what I mean with that, where you get to know the insides and outs of the Defiant, you know, when they're in the crew quarters and there's no pictures. Right. there's no furniture. There's like a bed and a table with a chair at the replicator, and that's it.
Well, I felt like the Defiant was as close as Star Trek got at the time, because of course Enterprise is a separate conversation, the show Enterprise, but it was as close as we got to like an actual like submarine.
Oh yeah, no, I know what you mean. Limited space, and you make the best use of all available space that you
can.
Everyone's
bunked up together. You know, you don't have these big quarters. You know, the mess hall is very utilitarian. It doesn't have a lot of the luxury stuff that, you know, the Federation's made fun of a lot by non-Federation members, right? It's like what Quark makes fun of when he talks about the root beer, you know, how bubbly it is, just like the Federation.
You remember Unification when they're on the Klingon ship and they roll out the bed, and they pull out the bed, and he slaps it, he's like, we do not weaken our bodies with mattresses.
Picard's like, good.
Just the way I like it. I'm like, there's not a single person alive that wants to sleep on steel. It's just never going to happen.
But the Defiant gets close, right? It removes all of those niceties, those luxuries, because it's for battle. That's what it was originally designed for. And so when they take it out, they're not having fun on the Defiant, at least not often, right? And I think that's, you know, why it was a good decision for DS9, because there's no reason for them to be on it all the time. They'd rather be on the space station. right? They'd rather go to Quark's and hang out in their nice big quarters and travel down to Bajor maybe a little bit.
And I'm firing from the hip right now, but I think even in a few episodes, is even when there's other people on the Defiant that aren't Starfleet, they have like restricted access. They're not allowed to see certain, I think that happened. They're not allowed to see certain parts of the ships, of the ship, because to Starfleet, it's still a warship. This is like our first warship we've dedicated to build for one purpose, and the purpose is to destroy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I mean, it was the first Federation ship to have a approved cloaking device. We could obviously talk about the TNG episode Pegasus, but you know, the Defiant had a cloaking device. At least the first Defiant had a cloaking device. The Sao Paulo, which became the Defiant later, did not have a cloaking device. But you know, it was just a very interesting ship. It was really different, and it's kind of contrasted by the next ship that we get, which is Voyager. So, you know, we had the original Star Trek had this big Constitution class naval vessel. TNG had the Disney cruise liner. Yeah, DS9 had the warship. And so Voyager has the science vessel, the state of the art.
The science. Yep, the science and exploration
absolutely
vessel.
Absolutely state of the art with the bio gel packs and the warp nacelles that would fold up to create a more sophisticated warp bubble. The Intrepid class starship, I always thought was a really sleek and cool design. When you see the prototype designs that they have, I am so glad that they simplified it down to what kind of feels organic.
Yeah, if it's a natural looking ship, I think it's good looking. I do like the warp nacelles. I like that it can still, it's a Federation ship, so it's still like, even if it's primarily science and exploration, it's still good at combat. It's still good at defense. It's not great, you know. It's not going to take on a Sovereign, or it's not going to take on the Negvar, that Klingon flagship they built for Gowron, but it can still defend itself, which has always been kind of a staple of Starfleet is, you know, even the Oberth class has like two phasers and a torpedo launcher or something. It can still defend it. It's not supposed to, but it still can. I mean, you look at our modern day science vessels now, you're like, oh, they don't have weapons. it's like, no, they don't. The Navy's not going to do that. They get... You have an anchor. You can throw it at somebody. That's pretty much it.
Voyager's a very interesting ship because it's also tiny. It's only 15 decks. It's a crew of 140-ish. And it was incredibly quick. It was very fast. It was very nimble. And it had the state-of-the-art technology. It was a brand new kind of warp core, you know, brand new gel packs, no more isolinear chips, which I thought was a nice kind of to see the evolution of that technology. I think the problem that the Intrepid class has in Star Trek is the unfortunate case of the only one we ever really see being Voyager, and its power set being constantly upgraded by alien technology to fit whatever the story was going to be.
Oh, yeah. Borg upgrades, this upgrade, that upgrade, blah, blah, blah. You're like, okay. I mean, yeah, you bring up a good point.
And it did have one of my favorite features. And that was the fact that the whole ship, the whole thing, could actually land on purpose on a planet. And this was so cool because, you know, the Enterprises couldn't do that. You know, we were always sending shuttles down or beaming people down or whatever. And Voyager could land. Not only could it land, but it lands in the first episode.
Well, speaking of Voyager, we see a few other Federation ships that we could talk about. You know, the episode with the Prometheus, which was kind of weird.
Well, it's that's not really a Starfleet ship, though.
It's not a Starfleet. Yeah, you're right. But the reason I bring it up is the only other Starfleet ship we get to know, and it's driving me crazy. I've got access to all sorts of internet around me. I could look it up. It's that one scout ship that was also thrown back with them by the Caretaker.
Oh.
I keep wanting to call it the Rubicon, but it's not, because that's the name of one of the runabouts. And look, Derek and I are recording this. I could cheat, but I'm trying to fire it from memory. Because the Equinox, it was another science ship.
Yes.
But it was a drastically different looking science ship than, because the Intrepid class was like an exploration slash science ship, whereas the Equinox was a Nova-class science vessel. That's what it was. It was designed primarily for science, and it got jacked up in its time in the Delta
Quadrant. What I liked about that class of starship, the Nova class, is that it was basically the precursor to the Intrepid class. Right. If you look at its design philosophies, it's got a front end that's very similar to Voyager, except, you know, it's got the deflector is inside the primary hole. The secondary hole's just kind of back there. It's got standing nacelles that are kind of similar to a Sovereign class nacelle, actually. But it's a smaller ship. It's got half the crew complement. It's got half the number of decks. And I just thought it was a really cool kind of jump to be like, okay, so we went from the Nova class to the Intrepid class.
Well, and I think it even fits the story of what they did with the whole Equinox, where Janeway and company are kind of judging the crew, and the one surviving senior officer was basically like, I had no resources. Look at my ship. My ship was not designed to be gone from Starfleet for more than like 6 months or something. My ship was a small science vessel trying to survive on its own. And it doesn't mean you're proud to see Starfleet act that way, but there's a certain logic that every human understands when you're in command, you're trying to take care of your people. And you know, you're like, my ship's never going to survive 70 years back to home. You know, even in early on in Voyager, Janeway and company were pretty confident. Like, oh, it's going to take 70 years, but we'll get there. It's like the Nova class. You get the impression, no,
I think those two ships show the same dichotomy that we were just talking about with the Defiant, which is the Intrepid doesn't really have the niceties. It doesn't have the luxuries. There's no holodeck, let alone two holodecks. You know, there's no EMH. There's no, galley with a cook and, you know, massive cargo bay that they could turn into whatever they want. I don't even know if the ship could land if they did find a planet that they wanted to land on. I'm not even sure about that. It was much smaller. And when you have half the space and half the crew, there's just less technology involved. Voyager had a lot of really positive things. It had all this new technology, you know, so it was significantly faster. Than the Nova class would have been. And it is an interesting comparison, because even though Voyager is a smaller ship than what we might have been used to in Star Trek, it's like the big sibling in this episode, Equinox.
Well, and I like that even the writers, they used like a Nova class ship, because if they sent back like, you know, an Akira class battle cruiser, it's like, well, that ship's going to be fine. It's got technology, it's got armament, it's got luxury. The Akira class is going to be okay. And the Voyager's kind of like in the middle, where it's got all this technology and amenities, but it doesn't necessarily have the power. And so that's why they have to kind of come up with all these fun plans all the time. And just finishing my rewatch of Voyager not too long ago, they do a lot more tricky stuff to make it through compared to some of the other... I mean, the Defiant class was... That's a sledgehammer. When Sisko wanted to get something done, they fire their pulse cannons and quantum torpedoes and they blast their way through. You know, the Voyager, the Intrepid class is not going to do that.
So,
and that's...
No, I think you're absolutely right. I was actually about to say that I made a mistake earlier, and I want to retract something that I said right here on the show. When you mentioned the Prometheus, I was actually thinking of a different ship. You're talking about the state-of-the-art vector ship from Message in a Bottle, where Andy Dick plays the EMH Mark II.
And we never ever see that ship ever again. Anywhere.
I was unfortunately confusing it with the alien ship. My brain's scattered right now. There's that alien they meet that's trying to trick Voyager because Voyager helped the Borg fight Species 8472.
Okay, I got it.
And he creates the ship that appears to be Starfleet, appears to be a Federation ship, but it's not. The whole thing's a trick. That's what I thought you were talking about. Totally my bad.
Okay. Well, no, I mean, but that's the thing, is they introduced a Prometheus with this tri-vector attack thing that can apparently destroy a warbird in 10 seconds or less. And you think a ship like that, they would build a fleet of those, and again, we never hear from it ever again. Like, it's not even hit. I don't even know if there's books about it.
Yeah, I don't know. Because, you know, maybe it's just too complex of a design. You know,
Maybe they said, like, this is a little bit too much God mode, almost.
Well,
the ship can
part
do.
Of the problem is that from a canon perspective, we don't have much from the Federation after this point. You know, Voyager goes home, and that's it. That's basically all that we know. We have Nemesis, and in Nemesis, we don't get to see much from the Federation. It's really Romulans. So maybe the Prometheus is around all the time. Maybe that class of starship, which was called the Prometheus class because it was the only ship, you know, maybe there are a bunch of them. Maybe, you know, there's a bunch of Andy Dicks running around in the Federation. I don't know.
Oh, God. Let's hope not. But I will say message in a bottle. So all of us have that thing where we divide up certain parts of our favorites. You know, this is my favorite ship, or this is my favorite character, or this is my favorite side character, blah, blah, blah. Message in a Bottle has my favorite, I think, 5-second sequence in all of Star Trek, which is when Andy Dick and the Doctor are working to get control of the Prometheus, and the Federation sends 3 ships, the 2 Defiance and the Akira class, and it's when they all 3 come in and, like, guns blazing. I'm like, that is just, like, even to a Romulan, you'd have to think a Romulan's intelligent enough to go, shit, 2 Defiance and an Akira class battle cruiser, and they just came in firing. There was no hail. There was no stand down like, you know, you would typically think Starfleet would do. Nope, they're like, they're taking over the Prometheus and we're going to attack all the ships we see at the exact
guns
same
blazing.
Time.
I mean, the Dominion War had happened. The Federation's like, we're not screwing around anymore. You want to fight? Yeah, Let's do this.
Exactly.
You know, because I think what's interesting about Starfleet, specifically as it comes to the fleets of ships, is, you know, they're always talked about as like the weaker group. Right, they're always the underdog in all of these battles. But you know, they created a treaty with the Klingons. The Klingons didn't win. The Romulans didn't win the Romulan War.
No, we nuked their homeworld.
And the
atomic
Dominion
weapons
and the Cardassians, they didn't win either. And yeah, they're the good guys. So narratively, they're going to win more often than not. But if you want to look at it from a future historical perspective, the Federation was able to be on the winning side of at least 3 massive wars, 4 if you want to count the battles against the Borg. They do come out on top at the end of the day. And maybe it's because the ships, it is the technology, it's the people, it's the ingenuity behind them that they can kind of create these unique situations. And then you give them that post-war feel of, we're not going to get pushed around right now. And so then they've got the Defiant and the Akira class, and they're just going to come flying in, because 10 years ago they didn't have that. These poor schmucks are on an Excelsior class, you know.
Well, and again obviously I know Star Trek isn't real, but it is, it's a documentary of the future. Derek, I've been saying this forever, but even so, think about, okay, let's put this into perspective. Let's talk the first Borg invasion in 2369, Best of Both Worlds. Is they're able to get through parts of Romulan space untouched. They're able to get through the entire Federation. They're able to wipe away one entire fleet of 40 ships and get to Earth with basically not even flinching. Imagine if tomorrow, all right, the president goes on TV and he's like, the Russians have just attacked Washington, D.C., we've got 20,000 casualties and DC's been taken. The whole country would be like, what the, what, how did we fight? Did we not fight? Imagine that culture shock to the Federation. We're like, holy shit, we literally almost lost. So yeah, building a defense fleet, not only does it make sense, there's probably people in Starfleet that have been saying, you know, we probably should have listened to Admiral Cartwright back in, you know, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, and built this war fleet 100 years ago.
It's an interesting conversation because a lot of the ships that we've talked about have some pretty substantial firepower. The Constitution, the Galaxy, the Sovereign, the Defiant. But so many of them don't. So many of them are science vessels. Yeah. You know, the Intrepid and the Nova and the Constellation and the Oberth and the Miranda. These are all science ships. They're exploration ships. So that's why I think this is probably a good time then for Greg, for you to talk about what I think is your favorite ship. And that's...
Oh, the Akira class. It is... Aside from why I think the name is amazing...
That's fair.
Because it means there's an anime fan somewhere in the 2380s designing a ship. He's like, this battle cruiser, It's like, is there an Evangelion class? Because that would be even better. But there's something I always loved about the... We only see it very minimally in Voyager and First Contact. But you read about it online, you see the sleek design. It's like a modern day... It's very futuristic, it's sleek, it's all one unit, it's all one piece. It doesn't appear to have individual, like, secondary hulls that are attached by something. It's a battle cruiser. Its sheer purpose is conflict. And the 5-second scene of it we see in First Contact, when it's just unloading on the Borg cube, you're like, man, this would have been valuable during Wolf 359. And it makes sense where the design isn't overtly elegant, it's not overtly complex, doesn't separate like the Enterprise or the Prometheus, it doesn't land like the Intrepid. It was designed like the Defiant. It's designed for war, so it appears to be a little bit more simple with some of its capacity, but man, do I love it. And maybe I love it because the only Akira-class ship that's in canon is the Thunderchild.
That has a name, yeah.
Yeah, that has a name, which is from War of the Worlds. That's the British cruiser. That's the British cruiser that rams one of the tripods and destroys it. And so, I mean, there's a chapter called the Thunderchild. I'm like, that's just.
I never made that connection. That's nice.
But yeah, it's the Akira class. Ever since I saw it in First Contact, I was like, what is that? I have one of the Eagle Mosses up on my railing. I'm just going to buy 15 more Akira class Eagle Moss.
Well, so there's something interesting about the Akira class. I like it too, so I don't mean this as a negative. But if you look at its design, it kind of looks like an upside down NX-01.
Oh, now I'm never going to be able to unsee that.
Now, the Akira class was first, right? Because it is in First Contact. It's in DS9 a bunch of times during some of the big battle sequences. So it was first. And I'm wondering if the design for the NX-01 Enterprise was based heavily off the Akira or not, because they're basically the same size ship. The saucer is almost identical. The difference is the big supports that are on the top of the Akira class are just not really there, and the Enterprise kind of has them connected underneath. But they're very, very similar designs. And I just think that's interesting.
Well, I mean, I'm pulling up the designs right now, and you are not wrong. They are... It is literally like they took the Akira class and flipped it upside down and said, oh, NX-01. I mean, even the little middle connection spot.
It's very similar. It's a little more pronounced in the Akira class. And maybe that was on purpose. I don't know. But it's just kind of funny because, and I've seen some people kind of complain about it. I'm not complaining. I think it's just a fun coincidence. But it's interesting that, like, maybe this design is really like 200 years old by this point, because the NX-01's, like, from a structural standpoint, is basically the same. Obviously, the interior would be completely different, right? Because the Akira class has state-of-the-art weapons and warp drive and all that. But I just think it's a fun kind of bookend, because the Akira is one of the later ships that we're introduced to in Star Trek. And it looks almost exactly like what, chronologically speaking, would be like one of the first ships.
Well, I was just Googling while we were talking about it. Somebody put a side-by-side image and they circled all the similar parts that were used on the models. And there's a decent amount of them. I've never given it that much thought.
I mean, there's something to be said for the consistency in Starfleet, right? That the ship designs all share certain attributes. That really there's some outliers. The Sovereign class is a bit of an outlier. The Defiant is a bit of an outlier. But you see so many of these other ones where... The Akira and the NX class, the Nebula and the Galaxy, right? The Constitution and the Excelsior. There's so many similarities with these that you can tell they're created by the same organization that has the same goals, a lot of the same people on these teams. And it's just kind of an interesting kind of back and forth about which direction these designs take over time.
I mean, hell, if you look at just the top-down silhouette of the Akira and the NX, I mean, yeah, they're shockingly similar, I admit.
Yeah.
What about yours? What's your favorite?
My favorite really is that refit Galaxy class from All Good Things, the Dreadnought, as they call it in Star Trek Online. I love that because I feel like it took what I think is a very gorgeous design of the Galaxy class and gave it some edge. I think one of the problems with the Galaxy class is it's a very happy looking ship. It's a very nice looking ship. And
I mean, Some Edge, it destroyed two Klingon battlecruisers in 10 seconds.
It's a sleeper. It's a, but the, but that's the thing though. The refit really gives it edge, right? You've got the extra phaser cannons on the top of the saucer. You've got the massive phase cannon on the bottom of the saucer. You've got the third nacelle. You've even got like these little kind of fins that come off the bottoms of the nacelle structure on the secondary hull. It just kind of gives it some edge, gives it some intensity that I think the design really needed. So that was absolutely my hands down personal favorite, just across the board. After that, it gets tough. It gets difficult after that. You know, that the refit of the Constitution class is such an iconic design in science fiction, in pop culture, that even the people that make fun of Trekkies still know that that's a Star Trek ship. Right. Because like it was funny. Like, so as a kid, and I still have the same vanity plate, but as a kid, when I was 15, I got my first car. I had a vanity plate of a way to spell Enterprise. And in high school, a couple of times my car was like mildly vandalized and people would make Star Trek jokes on it. And like, I was trying to wrap my head around it. I'm like, wait, hang on. So you saw my license plate. You knew what it said. You knew what it was referencing. So what's the difference? Like, you know what it is, right? It wasn't like I had a picture of Bender on the side of my car and you're like, oh, Futurama. Like, it was, I don't know. But,
Wow. I mean, Futurama's amazing, wow, but so is Star Trek.
I love Futurama.
I mean, my vanity license plate is Lord of the Rings, so it's four Gondor, nice. Literally. Every so often I'll see people pull behind me and like take a photo.
I used to get people a lot do like, you know, the Vulcan salute and things like that to me when they would pass.
Oh, yeah.
The problem with that is I can't do the Vulcan salute. I don't have the muscle control to do it. I can't do it.
We're going to have to. So what you all aren't seeing is Derek and I are videoing at the same time, and I can do it with both hands.
I
can do it
if I split like, so it looks kind of right, but like.
So you're doing the Shatner.
Okay. And so I always feel guilty when someone does it to me because I feel like I'm a jerk not able to return the favor. all right. So
you're like, man, I want to do something for him. You just flip him off. I'm like, Derek, no. What's wrong with you?
So like, we're over the hour mark now. There's obviously other ship designs we didn't touch on. We didn't get to Discovery. We didn't get to the Kelvin timeline. We didn't really
last thing, because you mentioned it. So the Enterprise refit and all good things. I don't know how many people are familiar with this, but in the original series, there was a Dreadnought class battleship. Well, just it was a Dreadnought. It had three nacelles in the same style as the Enterprise refit.
And I think that's why people, at least in Star Trek Online, started calling it the Dreadnought as a kind of a homage to that. And there's a few other ships that have, you know, multiple warp nacelles. Like I said, the Nebula class has the option for a third. Obviously, the Constellation class has four. They tried to play around with that, right? Voyager had the two, but they would fold up when they would go into warp and things like that. And I appreciate those different concepts. Greg, is there anything else you think we should touch on today? Obviously, we're gonna have to do a part two just to cover the rest.
Part two, three, you know? Four, yeah. It's just, I think that's something where, you know, Star Trek and Star Wars, probably the two biggest sci-fi space operas right now, even in most TV history. The Expanse is great, but it's still not that big. The Orville is still kind of small. Battlestar Galactica's got its niche. But there's something about Star Trek where people have always been fascinated by the ships. And yeah, people are fascinated in Star Wars, but if they like the Imperial Star Destroyers. But then the Empire builds a bigger one, and then a bigger one, and then a bigger one. You're like, all right, well, this is just getting kind of... All right, now you have a moon. You're like, all right, this is just getting kind of weird. And the that's Rebellion no ships or the Mon Calamari ships, yeah, that's no moon. And the Mon Cal ships are like, oh, they used to be like cruise ships. And then you're like, oh, okay. But then you think about it, you're like, wait a second. It was like a space cruise ship that was like 3 miles long and had these amazing shields. You're like, that doesn't... You're like, at some point, you're like, that doesn't really jive to me. But Star Trek, has always dumped so much lore into their ships. You know, in Star Wars, you have the Millennium Falcon, you have Luke's X-Wing. what other ships do people really care about?
Slave One.
Slave One, which, yeah. But you go to Star Trek, everybody's got... The ships are part of the story. They're part of the
there's so
love.
Many, like, right before we recorded, I posted in our Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/redshirtsandrunabouts. I'd love for you guys to join us. And I told people what we were going to talk about tonight and what asked people to post what their favorites are. And I mean, we got, the Nebula class, somebody put in there. We got, the Defiant, the Galaxy, the Sovereign, your Akira's in there. My Dreadnought's in there. We got the Intrepid class, the Constitution, refit, you know, like it is, it's all over the place. There isn't one right answer because there's dozens and dozens to choose from. And each ship seems to kind of have its own personality.
Yeah. I mean, each ship has its own personality and it makes you wonder or makes you realize that when people are going through the academy, you know, if somebody's like a super expert on warp core design, you know, they might not get assigned to an Akira class. They might get assigned to a Constellation class because of the warp cycling. Or an Intrepid class, is it makes more sense where, like any college, like high school, even for us, some of our teachers are like, man, Derek, you're really good at this, or Greg, you're really good at that. That's normal. That makes perfect sense that Starfleet would do that and go, we've got this specialized ship, you know, Greg, you're on the Oberth. I'm like, oh man, I don't want to be on a science ship. What do I know about science? You might remember First Contact, the room where they're looking down on the planet with the force shield over the window, and you have to get there through it. Like, what is the purpose of that room? Like, that's where I get assigned. It's like there's a panel that opens the door, and that's
My thought process would be like, maybe it's just like a lounge spot, you know, when there's just like a cruise mission going on, and they just, you know, someone just wants to go look at the view over lunch or something like that. Because like they.
Kind of, because
like, you know, the Galaxy class had like the Arboretum and it had gardens and you know, there was like, even like a bowling alley in the Constitution class starship, if I remember right, in the original tech specs. And so like, maybe this was, you know, something like that. It's kind of like your window view as a quiet spot. I don't know.
Maybe.
All right. Well, so here's the deal. Obviously, we'll need to do a part two. We have to talk Enterprise, Discovery, the Kelvin timeline, other stuff. And then at some point, I think we got to break down some of the other species ships as well. Klingons, Romulans, maybe some others. Those are the two that really get the love. So I think we'll have to come back to this topic if that's okay with you, Greg.
Yeah, I think we've got plenty of content to discuss for like 12 more episodes of just starships and science ships alone. There's no lack of content. And even with, I mean, hell, even the Borg, it's like, yeah, it started with the cube, but now you've got the spheres. Now you've got the battle cubes and armored cubes and all this stuff. I mean, and that's the other thing I think that this is a great topic to discuss, is because there's so much content out there and they're continually making new content on ships.
Absolutely.
So,
all right. Well, then I think this is a good time to wrap things up.
I think so. We're nearing the longest episode we've ever done, so we probably need to call it quits now, because I could keep going for like five more. I know you could too.
I really could, but this episode has to come out tomorrow, so I still have to prep it and get it ready to go. So, all right. So then, Greg, do you want to play us out?
Yeah. In case anybody's curious about where to find us, you can Google it. We're actually large enough now. You can just go ahead and Google Red Shirts and Runabouts. It'll take you to the Heroes Podcast website. Derek and team also host a variety of podcasts, and hopefully Derek will introduce at least one or two of them when he's signing off. If you're interested in getting in touch with me directly, you can do so on Twitter at @the_bittersteel. It's a Game of Thrones reference for any of you Game of Thrones fans. He was one of the great bastards from Aegon IV. I promise I'm better than just a great bastard, but maybe not all the time. But there's plenty of content on the Heroes Podcast. And like Derek mentioned, we have a Red Shirts and Runabouts Facebook group. It's very fun. It's friendly. I can voice my Picard opinions without getting destroyed. So it's one of those kind of in groups where we encourage diverse thought and diverse thinking. But Derek, have people wanted to get a hold of you? How could they do so?
I am the Star Trek dude. on Twitter, so you can come talk to me out there. I'm, of course, in the Facebook group that Greg mentioned. And also, I do host another show here on the network called Screen Heroes. We are actually recording and releasing our 200th episode this week, which is really exciting. This episode comes out on Tuesday, April 21st. We're recording our 200th episode that evening. And so that's really great. We're doing a sequel to our very first episode, which was the MCU, The Good with the Bad, where we way back in December of 2015 talked about what we thought was and wasn't working for the MCU. And now we're going to take a look back at it now, over 4 years later. So you can come and see me out there. And I think that's it.
I think so, but it's great being back. You know, I know we're talking bi-weekly, but hell, this was so good. If we get good feedback, maybe we'll record next week too. Since we're all stuck in quarantine land. But no, it's good being back. I'm glad to be part of Red Shirts and Runabouts. So again, you can track us down online on Facebook. You can look at the Heroes Podcast website, track down any of a variety of the shows, whether it's Screen Heroes or, you know, I'm personally recommending Red Shirts and Runabouts, of course. Of course. But until then, if you've got good feedback on this, tell us your favorite ship. Tell us your least favorite ship. Tell us why you don't like the Akira class. You think it's goofy because it has an anime name. I mean, you have a point on Starfleet using an anime name from 300 years in. It's like, Greg, what's your favorite ship? Oh, it's the Johnny Appleseed class. And that's when Derek hangs up on me. But catch us online, catch us on Twitter, catch us on Facebook, and we will be talking to you all soon.